morning, everybody. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Chris.
I've been able to attend at least part of every ANA retreat that's been put on up at this great place, and I'm really, really grateful for that. I remember the first one I went to. I was just going to visit a little bit, you know. I was just going to stop in, and it was on Friday night. I couldn't leave. There was just, you know, there was just so much happening. There was something really going on that was just so cool. I couldn't leave. I ended up going home on Sunday, you know, and getting all kinds of crap from my wife. ANA. Let me just talk a little bit about the history of what we do in ANA. For a gazillion years, people like us, hopeless alcoholics, hopeless drug addicts, we died. There was no other option ever. Okay? Rarely, I mean like 1 in 500, there would be a spontaneous remission that we'd be brought on by a vital religious experience. Like every once in a while, a hopeless person, hopeless people like us, would stumble into a religious group and we would get so involved that there would be like a spontaneous remission. And that would last about as long as our heavy participation in that religious community. As soon as we walked away from that, we'd end up drinking or using again. And this went on for centuries. And a couple of organizations got together, and their purpose wasn't to help the alcoholic or addict. Their purpose was to format spiritual exercises based on early religious texts. Quite possibly the first organization that had a lot of recoveries with people like us was the Washingtonians. Many of us have heard about them. What Washingtonians were like, has anybody in here ever experienced meeting dependence, or you go to like a gazillion meetings, there's not a lot of step work, there's not a lot of service commitments, but you're trying to stay sober by going to a gazillion meetings? You know, that's kind of what the Washingtonians were about. They were all about gathering and the fellowship and speaking and developing a community. Well, a lot of people who were heavy drinkers and quite possibly even alcoholics or drug addicts who got involved with the Washingtonians stayed sober. However, when their heavy-duty participation in the Washingtonians ceased, for whatever reason, they got drunk again. And so their remission was only very, very short-lived. Come around the turn of the century, a number of groups formed. There was the Jacobi Club, there was the Emmanuel Movement, there was the Oxford Group, there was a number of these groups. And what they were about were the spiritual transformation. In other words, they formatted a bunch of spiritual exercises based on religious texts. And they put them out there for us to use. If you study some of this early literature, it's uncanny how it parallels the step process that we are looking at here this weekend with ANA. There was surrender. There was inventory. There was restitution, which would be our amends process. There was continuance, which would be practicing the principles. There was prayer. There was meditation. There was witnessing to others, which would be basically our working with others. And all of these processes were really emphasized. So what was happening in these groups was every once in a while an alcoholic would stumble in. Remember, they weren't developed for the alcoholic. They were developed to kind of give rejuvenate your religious spirituality. That's basically what they were formed for. But every once in a while an alcoholic would stumble in. They would be so caught up in the enthusiasm of these movements that they would do these exercises and they would recover from alcoholism. Okay, it wasn't really the primary purpose of these groups, but they were getting a lot of sober drugs. In the Oxford group, there was a number of them. I studied the Oxford group many years ago for a while, and I found books that were written that predated Bill Wilson's membership in the Oxford group. Remember, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob both got sober in the Oxford group. There was no AA when they started. And, you know, I'm talking about this because it's the foundational recovery process comes from early Alcoholics Anonymous. So there was books like The Big Bender, which was a book about, you know, somebody who was just drinking himself to death, went to the Oxford group, sobered up, now he's a mayor or something somewhere. You know, he put his life back together. There was a book for pagans only. I was a pagan. Then there was a book for sinners only. And these two books had stories of people who had been down and out. I mean, just hopeless, just, you know, everything going wrong. Living in bottle gangs, you know, I mean, just really, really bad stuff. Who had been dragged into the Oxford group by people who were trying to witness to others and help other people. And they recovered and they put their lives back together. Now, that's where the book Alcoholics Anonymous kind of came from. Bill Wilson got sober in the Oxford group and participated. He was a going to meeting, working with others kind of a guy. He was doing the deal, and he got sober right away. Dr. Bob was going to Oxford group meetings, and he was coming late. He was leaving early, and he didn't want to work with anybody. You know, he thought it was all an overreaction. He was going for his wife. Well, guess what? Dr. Bob didn't get sober for 3 years in the Oxford group. Anybody in here go to meetings for years and years and never get sober? I would think. And the rest of you lying bastards. Anyway, one of the things that was noticed through their relationship was enthusiastic participation was necessary. The recovery process was basically the Oxford group precepts. But if you got heavy involved in those Oxford group precepts, and then you started to help other people get heavily involved in those Oxford group precepts, you stayed sober and you recovered. And as long as you were participating in that, you could stay recovered. Now, when Bill Wilson was on his detox bed, he was at Towns Hospital. This was his last detox. You know, Ebbie Thatcher had come in and, you know, helped him do some of the steps. You know, the story is in Bill's story. He laid back after Ebbie left on the bed, and the thought came to him that there must be millions of alcoholics out there dying. If only they knew this, if only they were exposed to this. I'm going to spend the rest of my life making sure that I carry this message to other alcoholics. And on his detox bed, he didn't make a decision to get better. He made a decision to help as many other people get better as he possibly could. And I, for one, am very, very grateful of that. Because I believe that the decision he made on his detox bed back in 1934 or whenever is the reason why I'm here today. Because I was a hopeless alcoholic. I was fast drinking myself to death. When I stopped drinking, I would need to be medicated because I would go into the DTs. Anybody in here ever experienced DTs? Yeah, they're fun, aren't they? You know, you hear marching bands and demons are running around the room. Oh, man. So anybody that's experienced the DTs, no, you don't drink much longer after that. You're not going to last much longer. You know, maybe 5 years if you're lucky. But one of the times it's going to happen is your aorta is going to blow. You're going to kill yourself through suicide. Alcoholics are 60 times more likely to take their own life than non-alcoholics. So be careful when you're filling out those life insurance forms. You know what I mean? The actuaries know that. Anyway, I'm fast drinking myself to death, so I come into the fellowship. Everybody in here has been to fellowships. Fellowships are great, okay? They're where we all get together. This is a fellowship meeting right here. It's where we communicate with each other. We find sponsors. We learn about recovery. You know, we find service commitments. The fellowship is a very, very important part of the equation. But remember, Dr. Bob was going to the fellowship and he wasn't getting sober. Bill Wilson was going to the fellowship and he got sober because they did two different things. One of them, enthusiastic participation in the recovery process. The other one, I don't want to be here. Okay, those are the two different attitudes. Now, Bill Wilson and some of the others put together the book Alcoholics Anonymous because it was a religious society. They thought, you know, religion is not a really good thing. There's a lot of people that get turned off by Jesus and stuff like that. So we need to make it secular. We need to make this religious practice secular. And so he basically did. It's the Protestant religious views still come out very, very strongly in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, but he tried to take all the religious verbiage out of there so that more people could feel comfortable, you know, approaching this process. Now, the book was written. When the book was written, the fellowship was small. All right, there was only a couple of meetings. So one of the really important processes in early AA was getting busy with the Oxford Group precepts, which were about surrender. You know, inventory, confession, restitution, continuance, witnessing to others. That's what they had. They had small groups of people who were trying to stay sober, but they were doing the deal as it's laid out, pretty much exactly as it's laid out in this book. And they had high recovery rates. And you gotta understand, the early AAs were really low bottom alcoholics. They were the people who had experienced the DTs. You know, I'll bet you out of the first 100 alcoholics, 90 of them had drank to the point where they experienced DTs. These were low-bottom alcoholics. So they had high recovery rates with people who were really hosed. Now, we need to remember that when we're looking at current fellowship practices. I'm certainly not up here to knock any other fellowships. I've come to a point in my life where I think we need everything. I think we need bad AA and NA meetings because they help some people. But I also think we need good ones. I also think we need ones that are really, really concentrating on the recovery processes because some of us won't make it if we don't get really involved in this. We're not going to make it by sitting in a chair. The only way we're going to make it is by really, really working this stuff, you know, diligence. We beg of you to be fearless and thorough. I mean, we need to be fearless and thorough, some of us. Now, what happened in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous needs to be looked at real briefly because I think it was endemic on what happened to a lot of other fellowships. When you first went into AA, they would qualify you to be able to go into a meeting. In other words, there was no open door policy. You couldn't just wander into an AA meeting. They needed to know you meant business. And you had to show them you meant business by getting started on the recovery process. You needed to be inventorying. You needed to be making amends. That would show that you meant business, and they would let you in the meeting. So, obviously, they had high recovery rates because people were doing this stuff. Now, for the first 10 or 15 years in AA, it was a program with a support fellowship. Okay? What happened, though, when it started to grow, and a lot of people started to show up in meetings who hadn't hit bottom. They hadn't gone down the scale. They weren't the DT boys. You know what I mean? What they were there were people who had drinking problems. The drink was really causing problems in their life. And they were kind of shoved over to AA. So they came into AA. They're not rock bottom alcoholics. They don't need to do every single amends. They don't need to to be sponsoring and working with others to stay sober. What happened was there was a watering down process. Now, again, I've gotten to a point where I don't think this is either good or I don't think it's bad. I think it's what it is. I think that the people who haven't gone down the scale very far shouldn't have to go all the way down to be able to get help. So there should be an open door policy. You know, what happened when the traditions were written was the doors were swung way open for anybody with a problem to come in. But there was a consequence to that. What the consequence was now more people didn't need to do this stuff than did. And all of a sudden what happened was people started seeing the hardcore big book type guys as an overreaction. Okay? Man, those guys are hardcore. Let's go over to the meeting. Let's go over to the coffee and donut meeting where we can share. I just want to share. Okay? And that's what happened. And with the writing of the 12 and 12, it even got worse because now there was step meetings where you really didn't learn how to practice the steps. You learned how to talk about them. So there was a watering down in AA as it was growing. And the recovery statistics started to drop. And the chances of low bottom alcoholics staying sober going to AA dropped. And dropped and dropped. And I don't even know what the percentage is today, but it's not good. There are meetings that are they just don't have the power available for you if you're really in trouble. You know, so what happened in AA, that there was a number of traditions that were written. Primary purpose the primary purpose is to help those with alcoholism. Now, you know, from the 60s on, drug addiction really started to become prevalent. There was always drug addiction, guys. You know, around the turn of the century, it was laudanum addiction, you know, which was a type of opiate. You know, and then there was morphine addiction. I'll tell you what, I was doing some construction work down at Rutgers on one of those World War II chicken shacks that they used to deploy out of, and we were ripping up the floor. And this particular storage shed was a storage shed for medical supplies. And when we busted up the floor, we found all these prescription bottles that had, you know, fallen through a hole in the floor. And I picked one of them up, and it was a bronchitis medication. From 1942, bronchitis medication. What do you think the three active ingredients in the bronchitis medication was? You're not even going to believe it.
Morphine, cocaine.
Creosote, strychnine, and heroin. You know, that was the three. That was what your doctor was giving you in the 40s when you coughed too much. Okay, you might still cough, but you'd be happy about it. Taken out. So if you can get that, like, over the counter in the 40s, believe me, there was drug addiction. But it became very, very prevalent in the 60s and 70s. And all of a sudden, drug treatment started. Now, NA had existed sporadically since the 50s or so. You know, it would you know, flare up and die. But it really started to grow in the 60s. Now, they patterned a lot of their stuff off of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the model that they used. You know, if you talk to NA members today, they're going to say, we're a different group, and we've got our own book, and they're very much, you know, they very much feel like they're their own entity. But in the very beginning, they patterned themselves off the only model that seemed to work, and that was Alcoholics Anonymous. The problem is they patterned it off of the new type of model, which was the fellowship model, you know, the oral tradition model, the let's go there and share our problems model. Okay, so what was lost in both Alcoholics Anonymous and in NA was the foundational process of recovery that was outlined in this book. This process works now. It's difficult for other fellowships to come up with this because, I mean, you'd flat out be plagiarizing if you wrote it down word for word out of this, if you're another fellowship. But what I think needs to be observed is for any fellowship, I don't care if it's Overeaters, I don't care if it's Tower Snipers Anonymous. I think, you know,
you're recovered, right?
I think it's absolutely essential for you to go back and study the foundational document, because the foundational document is where it was happening. That's where the high recovery rates are. Who the hell knows what the recovery rates are in CA or, you know, any of these things anymore? You know, nobody really follows outcomes, but it can't be great. They followed the outcomes in the early days. They kept in touch with the people. You know, they knew who was staying sober and who wasn't. So it's important for us to follow, to get back to the basic foundational document, you know, and without prejudice about, you know, well, I'm in this group or I'm in that group. Now, where A&A comes in is, you know, the history has been talked about many times. I'm not going to get into that. But what was decided among the founding members and among the trustees was that rather than have a fellowship with a support program, which is what the 12-step groups are today, they used to be a program with a support fellowship, we were going to go back to the model of a program with a support fellowship, because that's really what worked. So some things had to be changed. You had to throw out the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Who cares about that? That doesn't help anybody. That just gets you in the door and makes you think that if you sit in a chair, you're going to get it from osmosis. That, you know, I'm saying that it was a good idea that they did that, because it swung open the door and a lot of people were helped, but it was a bad idea for people like me, because it made me think that, well, the only desire to, you know, for membership is to just come in and say, I'm here. And you know what? I did that in the beginning. I really thought that the 12-step fellowship was about convincing me on a daily basis to not drink. It would remind me continually that it's a bad idea to drink. And I'll tell you, it works for a lot of people unless they're in real trouble. If they're in real trouble, it doesn't matter how many times you're reminded you're not going to drink. You'll remember that you shouldn't drink while you're on the way to the liquor store. Or you'll figure, you know, it's a really bad idea for me to shoot up this bag. You know, I've been clean for like a week. This is really a bad idea. Ah, you know. It doesn't help. So for the people that are in real trouble, there needed to be a solution. There needed to be a place for them. What had happened is that everything had been so watered down that there was no place for the real drug addict, the real alcoholic anymore. The processes in the other 12-step fellowships were about, you know, the most good for the most people, you know, which is, I guess, as it should be. But we knew what worked. We knew that practicing the recovery process out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous worked. We knew it. We knew it. There was guys like T and Jimmy and Ray who were pulling people out of NA who had been relapsing for 30 years, you know, and they're getting clean with these guys going to the big book. There were people we were dragging out of AA who were in really bad AA meetings, you know, and taking them into this book, and they were getting sober for the first time in their lives. I mean, we had actual experience, and we saw that it was working. So that's what happened. The first A&A group started in Burnsville, and they didn't care what your problem was. You smoked too much doobage. You were a dope fiend. You were a crack. Nobody cared. What they cared about was, how willing are you to recover? Are you willing to do what these first members of Alcoholics Anonymous did? Because we can promise you, if you're willing to do this, and then be consistent where it says to be consistent, be honest where it says to be honest,
If you're willing to do that, your chances are unbelievably good for a permanent recovery. Not only separating from whatever substance you're having a problem with, but to be able to rebuild your lives, you know, to be able to start getting some quality of life back, to start not screwing up all your relationships, to start being consistent where you want to be consistent, to start growing up, you know. We could promise that. And the people who paid attention and actually did this all of a sudden became soldiers with us. You know what I mean? Because, whoa, this stuff works. And now they're out there carrying the message and they're starting A&A meetings and, you know, they're sponsoring people and they're going into the fellowship where every once in a while somebody will stumble into one of those fellowships who's in real trouble. You know, they'll be in there. You know, so they're like, hey, come with us. You know, we'll sit down and we'll do the book. I want to tell you some good things about where A&A is right now. You know, this is an important retreat because we're considering and we're figuring out how A&A needs to grow from here. Okay, it's about ready to really grow. Just in the last 2 months, two A&A meetings started in Texas. One outside of Dallas, one outside of Austin. I'm in Copenhagen, Denmark last year. And I'm over there on a commitment, and I'm standing by the coffee table, and I start talking about A&A. Yeah, we got this cool thing going on in New Jersey, A&A. And a girl 10 feet away turns to me and goes, oh, I'm in A&A. I'm like, what? And I head right for her, and I start asking the questions, right? She had a sponsor from Iceland. Jimmy and Ray flew over to Iceland, what, 4 years ago?
3 years ago.
Three years ago, because Iceland wanted A&A. And what had happened over there is, remember, this is a program with a support fellowship. What happened over there is they didn't bother with the meetings. But they paid a lot of attention to the process. So they started saying to people, hey, you want to go through the steps the A&A way? And in Iceland, it spread. A lot of people in Scandinavia, you know, go back and forth to Iceland. There's a girl standing right next to me who has an A&A sponsor in Iceland. So it's now in Denmark. There's a chance that this thing might happen in Minnesota. I mean, it's a great time for this. You got to understand this is really needed. That there's... It's part of a renaissance process to get back to the basics of what worked for people like us. We need to pay attention to this stuff. There's a lot of things out there that are really good, but that won't save us. You know what I mean? Being the cookie guy at the meeting is a good thing, but it's not going to save you. Signing up for speaking commitments is a good thing, okay? But it's not going to save you. There's a lot of great things out there that pull you away from the important process of recovery. And what A&A wants to do is just focus on that. That's all we want to do. You know what I mean? I'm speaking for other people when I say that. Maybe I shouldn't do that. But that's all I think A&A should be doing, is pointing people to the process that will bring them into contact with that which will keep you sober and allow you to recover. A conscious contact with God. So many of us our chances are so less than average. We hope desperately for a spontaneous remission sitting in a meeting, you know. And sometimes they happen. But if you want to improve the odds of having a really good life, of getting away from these substances that are killing you, you got to start with this stuff. If you're in real trouble, you got to start with this stuff. You know what I mean? You just have to. Some of the craziest things I see today are people who actually think that if they go to a meeting and they share their problems, they're going to be able to stay sober. You know, I go to these meetings and I think, you know, what are you doing day after day, just coming in and sharing it? Why do you have problems? You know what I mean? Pay attention to the foundational documents, and you're not going to be going into meetings sharing about the problems. You'll take the problems to your sponsor and the solutions to those problems to the meetings. And then you can be of some actual help in the meetings. You know, you'll be a beacon of hope rather than a pain in the butt. You know? And again, in A&A, we're not saying come to A&A, forget those fellowships. I think it's important to stay in touch with those other fellowships. Because where better to find people to work with? Where better to find prospects who are in real trouble? You know what I mean? So if you're alcoholic, man, stay in touch with AA. If you're going to dive into this A&A thing, if you're a heroin addict, stay in touch with Narcotics Anonymous. If you're a crack maniac, you know, try to find the CA meetings and go there too. But remember the foundational process that leads to recovery, and try to help people get to that. There's so many people out there dying. You know what I mean? There's so many people out there dying. I don't know what the statistics are for drug overdoses and stuff like that, but it's huge and it's getting bigger. It's a big problem. And you know what's happening in some of the other fellowships is they're just not conducive to long-term recovery anymore if you're in real trouble. You know, they're a temporary pit stop sometimes. But if you have these fundamentals down, you're going to be safe and protected. You're going to be able to go about the Father's business. And by helping others achieve recovery, you're going to have the best life you can imagine. Some of the promises in this book are the best years of your life are ahead of you. You know, that's a promise that gets missed. Frequent contact with newcomers will be the highlight of your life. You know, and that truly is. These things have come true for me. And it's not about relief from the substance. It's about freedom from addiction. Freedom from alcoholism. Freedom. Go anywhere, do anything at any time, as long as you're consistent about certain things. My last spiritual advisor disappeared to India for 5 years. What do you think the people in his AA meeting would have told him if he said, I'm going to India for 5 years because there's no AA meetings? What do you think they would have told him? You're going to get drunk. You're not going to make it. Well, that's not what happened. That's not what happened. You know, he had this foundation in place. He knew what he needed to do on a daily basis to maintain his spiritual condition, and he did that. And he ended up starting a meeting, you know, over in India. You know, there's a lot of criticism that's leveled at A&A from the different members and different fellowships. That criticism sometimes is leveled by people who've never been to an AA meeting, don't know what's going on, but they're threatened by it, you know, because it might screw up their particular vision of status quo. There's criticism leveled at it by people who've come here and who have not participated in the recovery process. They've seen it as an overreaction, which it might have been for their particular, how far down the scale they've gone. They see it as an overreaction. Bunch of fanatics. Okay? That's all well and fine. In a state of recovery, you're immune to that type of criticism. You know? Don't worry about it. A&A is not for everybody. It's for the people who are in real trouble. It's a triage. Let's get you to God fast. Let's get you to start experiencing recovery so that you can build on that. So you can seek with God's help to develop that, to deepen that, and to start becoming the type of person you always wanted to be, the type of human being God would want you to be. You know? There's nothing more important if you're in real trouble with drugs or alcohol. There's nothing more important than this. There's nothing. Inherent in addictive illness is sometimes almost an utter inability to see how much trouble you're in or to buy into the process that you need to buy into to survive.
there's defaults that go on in our brain that just go to the wrong places. We can't think clearly when it comes to alcohol or drugs. We just, you know, we're a mess. And sometimes we need to be led into this. And sometimes we need to have enthusiastic people helping us with this. But what could be more important in your life than freedom from addiction or alcoholism and the ability to have a better quality of life every single day? That's been my experience. I got involved in this stuff around 1992 because I bought some tapes. And by 1993 and 94, I was pretty heavy into it. With some big book guys, you know, out in the Midwest who talked about this stuff. And then I started searching out other big book tapes. And then I found the Joe Hawk and the Mark Houston stuff and, you know, the Joe and the Charlie stuff. And there was just a whole bunch of people that I started listening to. And I really started to delve into this stuff. And that was about, I don't know, 15 years ago now. Every single year has been better for me. I mean, I don't know. If I stay alive another 20 years, I don't know where it's going to go. Because 2008 was an unbelievable year for me. And I just want to share some of the highlights. Because you got to understand, I was a pathetic alcoholic. I was living at mom's house. I'd lost my family. I'd lost my driver's license, 3 DUIs, terrible, horrible jobs, you know, terrible clothes, you know, never bathed, smoking 700 cigarettes a day, just drinking whiskey, just talking to the bottle, you know, it's you and me, you know. They all let me down, you know. I mean, I was just like a pathetic, pathetic alcoholic. I was scared to walk up my own street because I was a blackout drinker and I'd do violent things. And I just knew I'd done something that somebody was going to get me for, you know. And whenever I got my hands on drugs, like I remember this one time I bought a quarter ounce of Coke, you know, to sell to somebody. And he made me buy it for him because I had a connection. And then he called me up. He said, "No, I got it from somewhere else. I don't need it." So I'm sitting there with a quarter ounce of Coke and a bottle of whiskey. You know what happened, right? 4 days later, I'm like, blah, 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 blah. I just snorted it, you know, just snort. I mean, you know, I mean, I just was an addict, you know. I just couldn't stop. I cravings was just drinking and puking. And now this is me in 1989. Just all my scorecards read zero. People pitied me or hated me, you know, one or the other. And in this last year, and I'm saying that this is nothing I've done on my own, any of the stuff I'm going to mention. It's all the gifts of continuing to be consistent and enthusiastic with this recovery process. And I can't even say I've been enthusiastic. There are some times when, you know, you're just not enthusiastic, but I've paid attention to this stuff and I've tried to continue with these principles. In January, I went from being a bad electrician to a manager managing the processes of 80 New York City schools. I mean, this was a big job. I had an office with a window onto Park Avenue, 2 telephones, 600 employees. You know what I mean? It was a big job. And I did it really well. But it was taking a lot out of me. It was one of those jobs where, you know, it's just insane. And I'd worked my way up to that point. And prior to this, I'd always heard about like trusting in God with your job, you know, taking that leap of faith. And what happened to me was I started to really believe that God could have somebody else do this. You know, I mean, I have particular talents that, you know, somebody else can be making sure the boiler in PS 356 fires in the morning. You know what I mean? I don't care anymore. And I'm doing a good job, but my heart's not in this. And
I got offered an opportunity because of networking connections in AA. I got offered an opportunity to be a media director for an organization called C4 Recovery Solutions. And what they were proposing to me was a startup model. In other words, there's no money until we get this thing going. But if you want to do it... Now, I had been making some decent cash in New York City. And we had just sold a house, so there was some savings. So, you know, I talked to my wife and I said, you know, I really think I should do this. I really think this is what I should be doing. There's a risk involved, but I really think we should be doing this. And we had just bought a house and quadrupled our mortgage, you know, so there was, you know, there was a lot of worry. But the decision was made to jump into this thing, and in 6 months the money was coming in. So we're good. And I was just in a board meeting where we were funded for another year. Now, involving me in the C4 Recovery Solutions is what I do is I meet with and I interview the leaders in the addictive illness field worldwide. I mean, I'm in London, I'm flying all over the place, and the brightest and the best people who are treating us, you know, who we go to when we're in trouble, I get to network with, I get to interview, and put these interviews on the web for counselors, for people like us, anybody that wants to see what best practices are happening out there. An example, you know, I interviewed a guy who's the leading guy in adolescent cutting. You know, it's just all kinds of addictions. And adolescent cutting is a big thing now. You know, a lot of the young people are cutting themselves. And this guy, you know, I interviewed this guy for an hour, and he talked all about what it is and what you do and how you treat it and what's going on. You know, I'm the guy who's finding these people, interviewing them, putting them up on the web. I was asked to be a board member. I'm one of the board of directors for the National Council on Alcoholism. 6 months ago, they asked me to join NCADD. That's the Marty Mann thing. You know, that's the thing Bill Wilson was a board member of, and Dr. Bob. You know, so that's an absolute thrill for me. You know, I mean, I could go on and on with the things that have happened to me in 2008. But I got to tell you, there's another promise in this book that it says, if you allow God to be part of this process, He'll show you a life much better than anything you could have dreamed of. And if you would have told me, sitting there talking to the bottle in 1989, what was going to be happening in 2008, I'd have said you were out of your mind. It's not even something, I wouldn't have even wanted that for my life. You know, I would have, you know. So, I think what we need to remember is, by being of service, by being of help, by trying however we can to get the message of recovery out to as many people as we can, I think that's what leads us to a really amazing life. One of the things that I knew so many things that were wrong when I came into AA. One of them was, if you want a lot of stuff, just go out and get it, however you need to. Okay? I've found that that's a failed policy in my book. That never worked for me. The things that I went after never made me happy when I got them. However, if you go about the business of seeing how you can help others, everything will be added to you. Really wonderful things will be added to you. Things you didn't even think you would have wanted before you had. But once you have, you're incredibly grateful that you have it. All the promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous have come true for me. Stripping away a lot of the stuff that's, you know, secondary, ANA goes right to the heart of this particular book and this particular process. If you haven't yet, get really involved with this. We beg of you to be fearless and thorough. And then go about the business of helping other people and you have no idea what your life is going to be like. You have no idea what your life is going to be like. And there's people dying out there. If you feel strong enough to start an AA meeting somewhere, please do that. Please do that. Jimmy, Ray, me, whoever will help you. If you feel like you want to start a commitment somewhere, you want to bring a commitment into some place and just talk about the AA stuff, please do that. God is going with you with this stuff. You know, you will be powered by a power greater than yourself if this is your business, because this is God's business, this stuff. Let me tell you. You know, find the people in the fellowships who are dying, who everybody else is saying, you must not want it, you know, you're not trying hard enough, or you're not being honest, you keep drinking. They're ostracized in some of these other fellowships. Find those people and see which ones are willing to work with you on this stuff. And start developing a fellowship that you crave. That's another promise in this book. You'll develop a fellowship you crave. You know, Dustin is doing it in Minnesota. You know, I did it in Burnsville. Jimmy's done it in Manasquan. Do it, okay? You can do it. God is going with you on this stuff. You know what I mean? Get active, get involved, and get free. That's all I got.